The following is the July National Content Call for Paul Tedrick of the American Hospital Association of Chicago on Tuesday, July 9th, 2013 at 11 a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Paul Tedrick. Sir, please begin.
Good morning, afternoon, everyone, depending on where you're at. I wanted to welcome you to the On the Cusp Stop Cowdy Content Call Series. Today's topic is Health Literacy and Patient and Family Engagement, Strategic Tools to Prevent Cowdy. Our two speakers today are Barbara Meyer-Lucas. She's a project consultant with the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, Keystone Center for Patient and Safety Quality. Also is Melissa Manlovich. She is an associate professor with the Division of Nursing Business and Health Systems at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the call over to Barbara Lucas.
Thank you, Paul. Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to be talking about two principal concepts during our time with you this afternoon. First, helping you to understand the concept of health literacy and its role in your work on cowdy prevention. And secondly, Melissa will be speaking with you about understanding the importance of engaging your patients and families to help your teams prevent cowdy. So moving to slide five, we're starting first of all with an introduction to the concept of health literacy. And during this first half of the talk, we'll be hoping we leave you with a clear definition of the concept of health literacy and its implications for patient care. We'll be walking through some of the major barriers that all of us face when we're dealing with health literacy issues. And finally, we'll be leaving you with some concrete strategies to help you enhance health literacy with the patients on your floor. So moving now to the next slide, slide six, I wanted to start, first of all, by talking about what do we mean by health literacy. It's a term that's very much in vogue and we hear a lot about on a number of the process improvement and quality improvement projects we're all involved in. But put very simply, health literacy is the ability to obtain, understand, and act on health information. And it is very definitely dependent on a clear exchange between patients and their families and all of us on the medical team. Moving to slide seven, if we take a step back and think about one of the premier reports that got all of us initiated in the path to improving safety for our patients, the document called Crossing the Quality Chasm, which was released in 2001 from the Institute of Medicine, one of the major contributions that report made to all of our work is by outlining key healthcare dimensions that we should all strive for in our patient care delivery settings. And that is that to have truly quality care, we need to make sure that that care is patient-centered, timely, safe, effective, that is evidence-based, efficient, and equitable for all of the patient populations that we serve. So if we're going to try to reach the establishment of these dimensions in the care we deliver, it's really important that we lay the groundwork by improving our communication skills with our patients and the families that support them. So moving to slide eight, why would it be important for us to think about this communication aspect with our families? First of all, we know from the literature that patients with low health literacy are more likely to be hospitalized, so they're at greater risk for winding up in the hospital. This is a study from the Journal of General Internal Medicine from 1999 that found that patients with low literacy are twice as likely to be hospitalized as patients that are literate. If you move to slide nine, we know that low health literacy also affects chronic disease management. One of the major areas that illustrated this was looking at diabetic patients, and this is a study from the Archives of Internal Medicine in 1998. That looked at some of the key components in terms of educating our diabetic patients. So when they checked to see whether or not diabetic patients could teach back to them the symptoms they should watch out for that might indicate their blood sugar was low, only 50% of patients with low literacy were able to describe those symptoms, and only as compared to 94% of patients who were literate. And perhaps more importantly, when we asked those patients, were they able to describe what they should do if they felt that their blood sugar was dropping, only 38% of patients with low health literacy were able to describe what steps they should take, compared to 73% of patients that were had a greater degree of literacy. If we look also at the area of patient safety, all of you on your units are aware of the issue of sentinel events. And as you know, the Joint Commission collects data on those and shares that feedback with us. So from a report that they released just this past February, we know that, for example, in 2010, there were 802 sentinel events reported to the Joint Commission, and 82% of those events listed communication issues as one of the key root causes contributing to those events. Similarly, they were involved in 61% of events in 2011 and 59% of events in 2012. So communication issues are often cited as one of the root causes that lead to significant safety issues as characterized here by sentinel events in the last 3 years. Moving on now to slide 11, how does this apply to our county prevention efforts? One of the key focuses of our talk today will be helping you to get your patients and families more involved in preventing counties in their care. And so definitely, if they understand the rationale behind that, we can help them contribute to making sure that we're using the appropriate reasons for catheters, making sure that catheters are appropriately inserted and maintained. And patients can also be engaged in helping us be aware to the fact that they need to come out as soon as possible. On slide 12, again, when we improve our medical communication, it will enhance patient-centered and compassionate care for patients that do have catheters, help improve their patient safety by reducing infection risk, and hopefully reducing prolonged hospital stays due to counties. So moving now to slide 13, if health literacy is so important, what are the barriers that are preventing us from addressing this adequately? And I'll be reviewing with you four major categories of barriers that we do find in regard to health literacy. First is the complexity of our current healthcare system. Secondly, patient factors. Third, physician attitudes and communication skills. And finally, nursing issues. There are other barriers as well, but these are the four major buckets that we'll be covering in the next few minutes. So starting first of all with the complexity of our healthcare system, if you think back to the way healthcare was delivered 35 years ago as compared to today, you can look, for example, at the treatment of acute myocardial infarction or heart attacks. So 35 years ago, if a patient was seen and admitted to the hospital for an AMI, they generally stayed in the hospital for 4 to 6 weeks of bed rest, and now we usually have a length of stay of 2 to 4 days. 35 years ago in the PDR, there were roughly 800 prescription drugs available, and now there are more than 10,000. Also, the treatment of newly diagnosed diabetes 35 years ago was very different from what we do today in that a newly diagnosed diabetic was typically admitted to the hospital and received 2 hours per day of diabetic education before they were released as being judged to be relatively competent to manage their problem at home. Now, largely this is done with outpatient management, perhaps 0 to 3 hours of classes. We rely on handouts, internet, and in some cases telemedicine to manage our diabetic patients. So a very different scenario from 35 years ago. Moving now to slide 15, as I said, there is an increasingly complex healthcare system, and this is also manifested by the fact that many patients now, if they are admitted, are not cared for by their primary care physician or their family physician, but by the use of hospitalists, or they may be in a teaching hospital with an academic service following them. So there's a disconnect from their regular provider. We now expect much more self-care and self-education. There are multiple handoffs not only within our hospitals between units, but also to extended care facilities and ambulatory facilities. And as we know from our work with CUSP on the county project, every patient care unit has a different culture, a different set of expectations about how staff work together, and that can clearly impact how medical information is communicated to patients and how well they understand. This is an example from one of the states that we work with in terms of safety culture, using 8 stops, dimensions of safety culture. I think many of you on the Cowdy Project have seen this type of slide when we've discussed your data with you. But this is an example of the disparity we often see, and this is a very typical pattern that we see when you look at system barriers in terms of teamwork within units versus teamwork across units and handoffs and transitions. So pretty much across the board, we're finding that states score relatively highly on how well they believe they're working as a team within their units, but those handoffs across units and those handoffs and transitions for teams as well as patients are perceived as being less safe, and all of this can definitely impact how we're communicating information to our patients. So moving to slide 17, this is an example of some of the patient factors that can be barriers to understanding medical information. And this is the most recent National Adult Literacy Survey that was reported out in JAMA in February of 2012, in which adult patients were scored on 4 levels to see how well they read just ordinary information. This was not health information per se, but ordinary reading material. And the study was really informative in that it found that only 12% of adults in this country read at a proficient level, and that's roughly at a high school graduate level. 53% read at about an 8th grade level, but look at the triangles or the pie wedges that are red and orange. It found that 21% of adults in the United States read at about a 4th grade level or basic level, and 14% barely read at all. So if you combine those two wedges of the basic and below basic categories, roughly 35% of the patients that we are seeing in our healthcare settings essentially cannot read. They read at a 4th grade level or below. So roughly 1 in 3 of any patient that you're trying to teach about their healthcare problems or convey what you expect them to do when they leave the hospital or leave your ambulatory site essentially are not good readers at all. If you couple this then with the next slide, a patient-related barrier is aging. As our population ages, as the baby boomer population ages, their ability to read well also declines substantially. So in this study from JAMA in 1999, if you look at adult patients between ages 65 and 69, about 25% have marginal or inadequate literacy, but that goes all the way up to more than 70% by the time they're over 85. So you couple the general difficulty reading in our population with aging, and we have a significant barrier to understanding health information. Moving on to slide 19, however, we just wanted to emphasize here that patients, when they present to you in the clinic or in the hospital, are extremely vulnerable because we have them sitting on exam tables naked, sitting on that crinkly paper, and it's not really a teachable moment. Most people present to us for healthcare when they're sick, when they're afraid, when they're embarrassed. They're in a compromised setting already, and it's not really a teachable moment for the best absorption of health information. So even for patients that generally do read well and generally can function in an ordinary situation, when they're sick, when they're tired, when they're afraid, when they're in pain, it's an entirely different situation, and we have to keep that in mind when we're trying to convey information about their health, particularly when we're asking them to take action based on that information. So moving to slide 20, I want to touch briefly on some of the physician and nursing barriers that may occur when we're trying to convey medical information. This cartoon saying, I'm going to give you a mild sedative to counteract your really annoying questions, and is meant just to exemplify some perceived attitudes that physicians may have when they're meeting with patients. Physicians frequently cite to me when I do teaching about health literacy and communication skills, I just don't have time. I need to get in and out of the room. I have other rounds to do. I have to be down in another department. I have to go look at x-rays. I have another packed schedule ahead of me for this afternoon in my clinic. And so time is often cited. But we're finding out more and more as we study physician communication that some physicians really have difficulty being questioned by patients and struggle with being receptive to questions. So that can be an attitudinal issue that we have to come to grips with. Until recently, there has not been a major emphasis on communication skills in residency programs, but fortunately that's now changing. And this is one area that we do address with physicians to teach them how to be open to questions and how to listen more rather than just conveying information. So it's an area that's the subject of a much lengthier discussion than we have now, but something to keep in the back of your mind. Similarly, on slide 21, there are barriers that nurses encounter. And again, time is a huge barrier for all our personnel on units, but in particular for nurses. Nursing staffing ratios are always an issue, and there's so much information that nurses need to convey in addition to their clinical duties. So we're very much aware of that, and we're hoping as we move through this presentation, we'll give you some tips that will acknowledge that time barrier, but still help you find ways to communicate the information clearly. Another major nursing barrier is often there is a lack of clarity on the nursing and physician team as to what the daily goals are for that patient. For those of you that worked on the CLABSI project, you know that we emphasized that there should be multidisciplinary rounding so that everybody's on the same page. If the nurses are giving different information to the patients than what they heard from the physician, due to poor communication between those two disciplines, that can make it harder for patients to understand and retain information. In our particular project, this includes the reason for the catheter. So we need to make sure that if there is a legitimate reason for the catheter, that the nurses convey that in the same way that the physicians do. And finally, as I alluded to earlier, there are cultural issues between physicians and nurses and between units that can, even unconsciously, impact the way that we deliver medical information to our patients. So if we know that there are those barriers, the system barriers because it's a more complex health system, the patient barriers in terms of reading ability, age, and their embarrassment or their pain or their suffering as they present to us, and the physician and nursing issues, how do we move forward then with strategies for improving medical communication? On slide 22, we're going to be talking about system strategies and individual strategies that each of you can undertake as individual healthcare providers to improve your communication skills. So on a system level, we're going to be talking about creating a patient-centered environment on your unit and assessing all patients for literacy. And as individuals, there are things that each of you can do on your own to help improve your communication skills. So moving to slide 23, when we're talking about fostering a patient-centered unit, there are some key strategies or philosophies that underlie that concept. Again, remember back to the Institute of Medicine report, one of the key elements of having a quality healthcare team and a healthcare system is that it's patient-centered. So what that really means is that when people step on your unit, they can perceive that there's an attitude of helpfulness, that you are respectful of patients' privacy and dignity, and that you convey by the way you interact with them, that this is a safe place where they can share information with you about their health, about their social situation, about their learning skills, and you will not judge them for the place that they're coming from. In short, this means treating all patients as if they were your family. On the next slide, we also want to make sure that all of us are aware that we need to assess every patient that we come into contact with in terms of their literacy level. And so some ways we can do that are by asking, how far did they go in school? How comfortable are they with the way they read? How do they best learn? What is their social history or their support system? Do they have someone that typically helps them with their care, with their visits to the doctor, with their medications at home? And who is that person? And can we make sure that they're included in all the crucial discussions we have with that patient, particularly at the time of discharge? It's also important that we learn to start to watch for subtle clues that maybe patients don't read well. If you look at the next slide on slide 25, there are a number of red flags we need to be attuned to that may indicate that this patient has difficulty reading. They may have trouble completing the forms. If you give them a sheet when they first present to you and ask them to check off medications or to give you their past history, their initial set of complaints, they may have difficulty doing that. we may label these patients as being non-compliant in terms of missing appointments, not showing up for blood work, not going to consultant visits or following up on referrals, when in fact they could not read the instructions we gave to them or they didn't understand. These patients sometimes may seem angry or demanding, and they may be the difficult patient that you want to get in and out of the room as fast as possible with because they're so angry or upset or critical of you, when in fact they may be embarrassed about the fact that they can't read or they did not understand what you explained to them. And also, many times you'll have patients that have difficulty explaining concerns or have no questions for you because everything you said to them went right over their heads or they weren't able to read the documents that you gave to them. So moving on to slide 26, what can you do individually to help improve your skills when you're talking with your patients? First of all, remember that this is a dialogue, so try to sit at their eye level and listen more than you talk. Many studies have shown, with physicians in particular, that patients only speak for about 20 seconds before we interrupt them with another question or cut them off, assuming we understand what they're trying to tell us. And if you sit there and listen a bit longer, many times those patients will give you a much clearer picture and help you understand why they're presenting to you and what their concerns are. Always allow time for questions and try to explain things clearly in plain language, speaking slowly and avoiding jargon with patients. Many of you have heard training prior to this about team messaging, and basically what that means on slide 27 is that in any encounter you have with your patients, they should leave you knowing three things. What's wrong with me? What do I need to do about it? And why is it important that I follow this plan? It's very important that they understand why you're doing what you're doing with them or why you're asking them to do certain self-care measures when they leave your facility. On slide 28, I have an example of how we might apply this in teaching for a patient with a catheter. In this case, we're trying to make sure the patient and or the family member are understanding how to properly maintain their catheter while they're in the hospital. So the key message is, what's wrong? I need a catheter for a short time to drain the urine from my bladder. In clear, plain, living room language, not jargon. What do I need to do about it as a patient? I need to make sure that the staff and I always keep the catheter drainage bag lower than my bladder. And why is it important that I follow these instructions? I can get a serious infection if the bag is not positioned correctly. You don't need to go into retrograde flow. You don't need to go into the pathogenesis of UTIs. They just need to know where to keep the bag positioned and what will happen if that doesn't occur. On slide 29, similarly, if you wanted to make sure that the patient is a partner with you in monitoring for hand washing technique and the maintenance of that catheter, again, what's wrong? I need the catheter to drain the urine from my bladder. What do I need to do about it? What's my role as a patient? I should make sure that all staff clean their hands before and after touching my catheter. Why is it important that I follow these instructions to prevent a serious infection if staff don't clean their hands before caring for me? So this is a way to help get patients engaged, and by doing it with clear, plain language that tells them what they can do and why it's important that they participate. On slide 30, the fourth step that you can do as an individual team measure is to use a teach-back or show-me technique to make sure your patients clearly understand the concept you're trying to share. So, for example, you would ask, can you show me how you will manage your drainage bag when you go for a walk in the hall this afternoon? Or, I want to make sure I explained everything clearly about your catheter, so can you explain back to me so I can be sure I did a good job? That particular phrasing is one that I find really helpful because it takes the burden off the patient feeling like they just didn't understand, to us as educators saying, I want to make sure I did a good job in helping you. So it's a way of conveying to them that we're partners in this and maybe their failure to understand is on our end, not on their end, and it takes the burden off them. Try really hard not to ask, do you understand, because most patients will nod their head and say yes, even if they didn't understand what we were trying to share with them. Moving to slide 31, very briefly, if you're giving out education materials that are written, some simple guidelines, use 1 to 2 syllable words, short sentences, short paragraphs, no medical jargon, headings and bullets, and lots of white space. And there clearly are a lot of patient education materials out there on the web about Cowdy and about catheter care, but many of them don't meet this criteria. So if you're going to use those handouts, you need to be judicious and either do a shorter version that attends to these types of issues, or you are selective in how you give that advanced handout to patients and make sure they can clearly read it and understand it before you just default to that type of web handout. On slide 32, some additional hints, only use simple pictures, focus only on key points, and emphasize what the patient needs to do. When they're sick, when they're coming out of the hospital, and especially if they're challenged with reading abilities, it's important that they know what they need to do. The concept that you always hear of too much information definitely applies here. This is a time where you want to scale back, make sure they know what they need to do, minimize anatomy, physiology, and be sensitive to cultural preferences. So just to summarize on slide 33, remember that as many as 35% of your patients may not be able to read well. This limits their ability to obtain, understand, and act on health information. So again, health literacy is not just their ability to read, but it's their ability to have access to information, to understand it, and to act on it. On slide 34, we know that health literacy, if it is poor, affects the compliance with medical management. It increases their risk of poor outcomes and adverse events. It increases their risk for safety issues, infections, prolonged hospital stays, and it does increase patient and family anxiety as we send them out the door with the educational tools we hope will allow them to continue their care with self-management at home. On slide 35, just to review again, that there are barriers to health literacy in terms of complexities of our healthcare system, patients' reading ability, their age, the emotional overlay they bring when they're sick and in the hospital. All of us also carry along with us our own attitudes, whether we're physicians or nurses, that can affect our communication skills. And cultural issues on our units can carry over into the way that we communicate with our patients. So we need to be attentive to that as well. If we can improve patient understanding, we need to do it from both a systems approach, creating a patient-centered unit that also screens for health literacy issues, and also renewing our own individual commitments as healthcare providers to improve our own skills in terms of both face-to-face interaction and the written materials that we extend to patients. So I'm now going to turn over the second half of this call to Melissa, who will be sharing with you some particular strategies for success in terms of the patients and families we're dealing with on the Cowdy Project.
Wow, thanks, Barb. That was really very interesting. I know I've got one question already, so maybe at the end you wouldn't mind answering it. And that is thinking about health literacy as more than just reading comprehension and regular literacy. So in thinking about maybe some very well-educated people who just don't have a good grasp on health issues, and being able to identify who those people are and helping bring them up to speed. So just food for thought on that one. But anyway, we're now going to build on what Barb has said and talk more about engaging patients and families in the healthcare experience, and we're going to be offering several strategies for success. So for this part of the talk, then, we've got a few other objectives. First of all, we're going to talk about how to engage patients and families in healthcare. We're going to describe factors that influence patient and family participation in healthcare, and then we're going to use strategies to educate these patients and families about catheter harms. On slide 38, if you think about it, we can have two people walk into a hospital and have very different experiences of that environment, especially if one is a clinician who's walking in to start a shift or to start a workday, and the other one is a patient being newly admitted to the healthcare facility. So on the clinician and hospital staff side, they know how a hospital works and how to achieve results, but patients are strangers, at least most of them are. It's the hospital environment, and they don't understand the system or culture. As clinicians, we know who each other are, and we know what each other do. However, patients don't know who different staff are and what they do. Clinicians and hospital staff are very busy, aren't we all? And often we're under a lot of stress,
But patients, alternatively, are also under a lot of stress, but for different reasons. They're in pain, they're uncomfortable, they're vulnerable, they're afraid. They are aware that we are busy, and they may not want to bother us. So given that this hospital environment can be very overwhelming and foreign to patients, we need to take steps to engage patients and families in the healthcare experience. On slide 39, we've got a definition of what patient and family engagement is all about. It involves collaborating with patients and families of all ages at all levels of care and in all healthcare settings. Patient and family engagement acknowledges that families, however they are defined, are essential to patients' health and well-being. Collaboration implies a give and take, and it also implies not always insisting that the hospital or system way of doing things is best. So, for example, some patients may have as their part of their daily routine to have an evening bath before bedtime. Acknowledging and acting on the patient's wishes in this regard shows collaboration. Also, the definition of family may have to be stretched beyond what we may be used to. Just to give you a quick example, I once had a male patient who had a wife who visited, and he also had a girlfriend who visited at different times than the wife. And to be honest with you, the girlfriend was far more helpful than the wife. The patient was calmer when the girlfriend was present. He was more interactive when she was around. While legally she had no position, her presence during patient education helped keep the patient engaged. Looking now at slide 40, we have to think about presenting another way of thinking of patient and family engagement as having patients and families being members of the healthcare team and also acting as advisors. Many hospitals have patient safety or patient advisory groups that advise hospital leadership on various issues, but also just patients and their families themselves can often be advisors and members of the healthcare team. I once had a young 26-year-old male patient who, because of many genetic and congenital problems, he was in the hospital, oh my goodness, way too many times for any one human being to stand. But he had a GJ tube and got fed through that, and his mother was by his bedside and was very clear on the way that we as the nurses were to give him his medication. We were to draw up vanilla yogurt into a 60cc syringe, drop that 60cc syringe of vanilla yogurt into a warm water bath for about 20 minutes, and then through the GJ tube insert first about half of the yogurt, then the medicine, and then the rest of the yogurt. As a busy nurse who works in an ICU, I could have said, no, I'm not going to do this. This is not part of my job. You can do that maybe when you're at home, or put all kinds of arguments up for why I shouldn't do that. But the bottom line is I recognize that this mother was definitely the young man's advocate. This was the way they did things at home. And to keep her engaged, to keep them having a sense of control and of participation in the care of this young man, it was important, I could tell, that this be continued while he was hospitalized. So that's just an example. On slide 41, these are pointers that Barb has already made, but they're worth repeating because they are so important, yet we easily overlook them. As soon as you walk into a patient room, have your eyes go to the patient. Make that eye contact. If you're going to look at the chart, read it before you step into the room or look at it after you've made eye contact with the patient and introduced yourself. You can just tell on their face, who's coming into my room? What are they going to do to me next? And it's important that we alleviate some of the anxiety that Barb alluded to and make contact human to human, first of all. Introduce yourself by your name and by your role. This is something that I'm not always aware of when I go into a patient's room and say, hi, my name is Melissa, I'll be taking care of you today. I don't always say, I'm a nurse, and I'll be taking care of you today. So that's always an important part. You also want to introduce any other new people who may come to the room. Make sure that they are introduced by their name, their role, and by what they will do. It's important. It shows respect. It raises the patient to the level of a fellow human being who we have as a colleague, perhaps, or as an equal, I guess, is a good way to think of it. On slide 42, more pointers on how to engage patients and families.
When you first talk to the patient, when you first assess the patient, ask how the patient prefers to be addressed. I know sometimes I have older patients who don't mind me calling them Billy or Mary or Joe, and others who very much want to be called Mr. or Ms. or Doctor or whatever the title is. And it's important then to honor their wishes for how they want to be addressed. Identify family that should be partners in care according to what they want, what the patient wants. Highlight the main points of the communication tools. And by this, I mean be explicit about the best way to contact a healthcare provider. And also, you can invite the patient and family to use the whiteboard to talk with clinicians. We have whiteboards in each of the patient rooms in the medical ICU here at University of Michigan, and I tell the families, there's the dry erase, there's the marker. If you want a note, if you want to leave a note for the next shift or the next nurse, or if you want to ask the doctor a question, please, asking about and listening to the patients and families' needs and concerns, using open-ended questions. Like Barb said, don't ask, do you understand? That just kind of invites a yes or no response. You want to make sure that your questions are open-ended. You want to listen to, respect, and act on what the patient and family say. You can't always necessarily give them what they want or address their concerns immediately at that moment. It sometimes takes several steps, several stays. Days, but you can at least acknowledge what they're saying and let me get to it, let me work on this, and I will get back to you with a progress report. Help patients articulate their concerns when needed. Again, remember that the healthcare system is very complex. We can navigate it far better than patients. Sometimes they are raising concerns that we can somehow say in a way that gets the right response better than they can. And then, of course, be sure to obtain communication resources if the advisor or family member cannot understand you. This can be a translator. Sometimes even for patients who supposedly speak English, when it comes to medical terminology, that terminology might benefit from the help of a translator. On slide 44, making sure that you help the patient and family understand the diagnosis, condition, and next steps in their care. Give timely and complete information. Take every opportunity to educate patient and family using plain language, as Barb has so eloquently talked about already, and invite the patient or family to take notes. Now, inviting the patient or family to take notes may seem a bit controversial, but remember how anxious these poor people are. Memory and comprehension really take a hit when anxiety is high. Writing notes helps to keep facts straight and can serve as a reminder to patients and families about questions they want answered. I have an announcement to make here at this point that the Guide to Patient and Family Engagement was released yesterday. AHRQ, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, has posted this guide on their website, and a link to this valuable resource is provided on slide 59 of this presentation. So please, at the end of our presentation today, please go and click on the link and look at the Guide to Patient and Family Engagement. It really has just a ton of useful information. So now, the past few slides, we're on slide 45 now. We've talked about offering pointers on how to increase patient engagement in general, but now we're going to zero in on patient and family engagement as a way to prevent CAUTI. On slide 46, to provide some basic statistics on CAUTI, we all know this. There's really nothing new here. We know that it's the most common healthcare-associated infection. We know how symptomatic CAUTI increases costs. We know that people who have catheters inserted inappropriately or for inappropriate reasons are most likely to develop CAUTI, and the most common reason for inappropriate catheter use is incontinence. In one study, patient or family request was responsible for over 30% of inappropriately placed catheters, and in our own practice here at the University of Michigan, we have seen among our research team this very phenomenon. We know also that the risk for developing CAUTI increases 5% for every day the catheter remains in place. And it's really because of this information that we're talking about patient and family engagement today. Our hope is that by engaging patients and families, increasing their participation in healthcare, and educating them on the risks of catheters and CAUTI, that patients and families can make more informed choices, reduce catheter use, and help reduce CAUTI. Slide 47 shows factors that influence patient participation in healthcare, and these are really in two groups. There are modifiable factors and there are fixed factors. So looking on the modifiable factor side, patients have various degrees of acceptance of their patient role. Some patients may refuse to participate in decision-making.
So, for example, studies have shown that only 45% of women with breast cancer actually want to participate in decision-making about their breast cancer. The level of health literacy and the extent of knowledge that they have is another modifiable factor, and thanks to Barb's excellent presentation, we now have some strategies that we can use to help raise that level of health literacy. Patients have varying levels of confidence in their own capabilities, and to try to help patients increase their confidence, provide more information. Patients who are thoroughly informed feel more confident in their ability to make a decision. The type of decision-making required is another factor that could influence patient participation. So, for example, if the decision-making is to make a diagnosis, patients are not really interested in making diagnoses, nor are they qualified. However, patients are interested in decisions that analyze the value or utility of patient outcomes. And finally, looking at the use of alternative medicine, patients who use alternative medicine can be more inclined to involve themselves in decision-making than those who don't use alternative medicine. Moving on now to slide 48. So what are some education strategies that we can use for patients? We've talked about engaging them. We know how important that is. We've talked about CAUTI and how bad that is. So now what can we do? Well, first of all, we need to assess what the patient and families already know about catheters. And you can see how helpful it is to have engaged patients and families before doing any education. Through collaborating with patients and families, clinicians will have developed some idea of the patient-family attitudes towards catheters. You need to assess their readiness to learn. There are some times of the day that are better for learning than others. There are individual factors that contribute to this as well as system factors. So you can really... to be quite frank, it's a waste of your time to try to teach somebody something when they are just not ready to learn. It is far better to come back later or to try to assess or ask them, when would be a better time for me to come back? I can see that now might not be good for you. When can I come back and teach you some, give you some information about this? We need to ask our patients and family members how they prefer to receive information. Some people prefer a video because they're visual learners. Some people might prefer a pamphlet. But remember what Barb talked about with health literacy, how some pamphlets are not necessarily the best and how we need to screen them first. You also might want to think about the benefits of doing one-on-one versus group education. Group education sessions may be well received because often patients share common beliefs and it's easier for them to speak up in a group situation. They're not as intimidated, shall we say, or as fearful of speaking up when there are others around them who have similar interests. Additional educational strategies are on slide 49. They may seem pretty common sense, but they really bear repeating. Taking care of pain control issues, toileting, and other needs first before doing the teaching. Making the environment as conducive to learning as possible, whether it's things like turning off the TV or closing the door on a noisy hall. Make sure that the material that you provide is at a fourth grade reading level, remembering the literacy level of the vast of all Americans, I guess. And also chunking information into manageable pieces and providing one chunk at a time. We often think of education as going into a room and just doing all of our teaching in one grand session. Really the best way to do it is to provide a manageable chunk, which is probably no more than 10 minutes. And you can offer several 10-minute chunks spread out across a day or across several days. And before presenting any new information, assess what was previously provided and reinforce it before moving on to new information. A valuable resource that I wanted to share with you all is a website, catheterout.org. It was developed as part of an NIH-funded study that was co-led by Drs. Sarah Krein and Sanjay Saint here at in Ann Arbor. There are many, many sources of useful information for clinicians and patients on the family and patient and family education part of the website, So it would really be worthwhile checking it out. And I've got a link there that goes directly to the patient and family educational website. Other organizations also have information that is useful for patients and families. So on slide 51, I've got the FAQ sheet that is from SHEA, the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America. And this is also available online. Now, wait a minute.
let's just stop. This is one of those minutes when I really wish we were all together in the room at the same time, because I would hope that looking out on the audience, I could see a bunch of you raising your hands and saying, wait, wait, wait. Is this appropriate for patients with health literacy problems? And I hope that you would see that really, no, this is not ideal. There is not enough white space on this FAQ sheet. The reading level is probably above a fourth grade level. There are a lot of three, maybe four syllable words. Oh my goodness, Barb, this would definitely flunk a health literacy test. So my point here is that a lot of the information that is on the web really needs to be screened for health literacy first. This information can be used. There is excellent information, but it needs to be tailored to individual patient needs. Similarly, on slide 52, I've got an example of a pamphlet from the Catheter Out website. This information was developed by several co-investigators on the NIH-funded study that I mentioned earlier. It's got a lot of great information, but again, think about the health literacy level here. And would you really want to give your patient, all your patients, this? Maybe some patients could use this information, but for other patients, you really have to think about it and tailor it to their needs. So you may be faced with different scenarios depending on patient family wishes or previous experience with catheters. Remember, in the study I alluded to earlier, where over 30% of the patients and families actually requested a catheter. So you may be faced with this yourself. And it can be hard to find the right words. So on slide 53, we present a series of options that you can use, hoping that if one rejoinder doesn't help to convince patients not to accept a catheter, another one will. The first scenario on slide 53 talks about a patient or family member who requests an indwelling urinary catheter because the patient and or family does not want the patient to get out of bed. I think actually the information on your slide here is not correct. I was reviewing the slides last night in practice for today, and I think the information is wrong. So what it should be here for this first scenario, things that we can say are things like urinary catheters can be harmful. They can hurt the bladder and cause you to feel pain. Urinary catheters cause urinary tract infection, which could spread to your blood. Urinary catheters can tend to limit your movement in bed, and in your room, limited activity can make you weak. One of the best ways to recover from your illness is to get up and move as soon as the doctor says that it's fine to do so. Research shows that sometimes urinary catheters can interfere with your movement. So there are some suggestions like that that you can use to share with your patients. On slide 54 is a second scenario where a patient or family member wants the patient to have an indwelling catheter because they're afraid of soiling linens, or they're afraid of incontinence, or they're afraid of falling. Things that you can say now are things like, well, men can use an external catheter known as a condom catheter that is placed over the penis rather than in it. We can offer you a bedside commode if you feel you are too weak to walk to the bathroom. If you're concerned about falling, please let the hospital staff know, because there are extra precautions that we can take, et cetera. So again, these are different rejoinders or different comebacks that you can give to help the patient and family see from as many different angles as possible that perhaps the catheter is not in their best interest. And on scenario three then, oftentimes in previous hospitalizations, the patient has had an indwelling urinary catheter and does not understand the change in policy. So here's a couple of things that you can say. But the risk for infection is significantly lower without the catheter. And also, you know, before, when you were in the hospital previously, we really didn't know how harmful urinary catheters can be. So slide 56 just has a summary of what we've talked about. Beginning first of all from our own perspective as healthcare providers, we forget how frightening a hospital can be. And it's hard for patients and families to engage when we don't give them opportunities to participate in care. CAUTI remains a major, serious healthcare-associated infection, so strategies to promote health literacy and engagement may be important adjuncts in our efforts to reduce CAUTI. And that's all I had to say. So now I think it's time for us to open up the line for questions.
Yes, ma'am. At this time, I will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key. Again, that is star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Again, please press star 1 at this time for questions.
Melissa, this is Barb Lucas. I also wanted to remind everybody that the slides from today's discussion are available on the national website on the cusp.hai. So if any of you did not have the slides, they are posted there as well.
Great reminder, Barb. Thanks. And did you have any idea about my question about the level of education and the level of health literacy not necessarily coinciding?
Absolutely. I think a lot of times people believe health literacy is just referring to reading ability, and it's definitely not. It's their ability not only to first of all, to understand the information. And so that can be, even if they can't read well, if we do well with teaching them verbally and demonstrating, that's fine. They still can understand information that way. It may be tougher for them to obtain information. And again,
yeah.
Three components are the ability to obtain it, to understand it, and to act on it. So
yeah.
We need to make sure all three pieces are addressed.
Yeah, thanks, Barb.
Thank you, ma'am. At this time, our first question is from Kara Minnick from Glacier Ridge Health System.
My question was, she already answered it. I couldn't get the slides, so I will try to find them on the website.
Thank you, and I believe the recording of the call will also be there as well shortly.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *1 at this time. We are now holding for questions. Our next question comes from Mary Ellen Anderson from Heart of the Rockies Regional Center.
Yes, I was wondering if you could post the scenario 1 slide.
Yeah.
The correct one versus the repeating scenario 1 and 2.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I apologize for that again, and I'll definitely make sure that the correct one is posted on the website. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is Paul Pedrick with HRET. Just wanted to interject real quick. Apologize for any confusion. We just had the most recent update to those slides this morning. So if you got your slides any earlier than this morning, you probably got one that had a different slide. But everything is current that's on there now.
At this time, we have no questions in the queue.
Well, while we're waiting for the any other last-minute questions to come in, just wanted to remind everybody to fill out the evaluation for this call. You can find the link in two places. The first will be the link that is included with the slide presentation. And also, I will be sending out a participation report to all the state leads, and they usually turn that around back to you. That'll have a link to the evaluation. So we definitely want your feedback as we usually put out a report called the Evaluation Examiner to let you know what everybody has said and that we're taking your suggestions into consideration and what we're doing with those. So, operator, is there any other questions at this time?
No, sir, not at this time.
Hi, Melissa. This is Marie Masuga from the Michigan Hospital Association. I've been listening in with Dr. Lucas. I do have one last question. It's in regards to documenting nursing education and integrating that into the nursing care plan. Do you have any experience on maybe what works well, what doesn't work well in terms of making sure as nurses we are dotting our I's and crossing our T's and making sure that we are getting that into our individual patient care plans?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And the best thing I can offer is having patients, you know, verbalize understanding, doing teach back, having the patient be able to list the important points. Those are the kinds you want to have some kind of a sense in the note that it's more than that teaching was done, period. Teaching was done and the patient was able to verbalize understanding or the patient was able to raise additional important considerations or that kind of thing. For care planning purposes, it depends on you can do it in several different ways. So, for example, care plans for patient safety will often include plans to try to prevent falls. You can put teaching then related to catheters in that section. There's sometimes care plans for patient safety, so it can be doing in terms of reducing risk of infection, so teaching on CAUTI and catheters can be put in there. And sometimes you can just do a general care plan on knowledge deficit or increasing patient knowledge and then do it specifically on a whole care plan on CAUTI. So there's different ways that you can do it depending on what the overarching needs of the patient are. I don't know if that helps or not.
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, everyone. This is Paul again. It looks like we don't have any more questions, so I guess we can go ahead and wrap this up early, a couple minutes early at least. I wanted to once again thank both Barbara Lucas and Melissa Menlovich for their presentations today. They were absolutely outstanding. And on a final note, don't forget, everyone, that you can find our slides for today's presentation on our website, and you will also be able to find a link to the guide from ARC that Melissa was referring to during her presentation. That is also up there as well. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Have a great day.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks,
everybody.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.